Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, I'm Claire Mutimer.
And I'm Susie Coulson. Welcome to The Backstory. In each episode, we'll be hearing about an experience that has happened to someone that shaped who they are.
30 minutes that remind us that everyone's dealing with something. So we're a documentary podcast. A docupod.
Except you made that word up. Welcome back to part two of Me, My Baby and Psychosis, Jess and Matt's story. Do listen to part one if you haven't already. We join them and their baby Albert on the way to the psychiatric care mother and baby unit at Homerton Hospital in London. It took them 6 hours to get out of the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital and into the car, as Jess was suffering so badly with her psychosis. But finally, Jess, Matt and Albert were ready to drive through the night with the crisis team to the mother and baby unit.
So we all made this sort of almost like a pilgrimage to Hackney, and it took a journey that would have taken two and a half hours, took 6 or 7 hours.
But the amount of stopping and starting that we were having to do, managing Jessica, and she was, you know, confined like an animal in the back of the car with me and Albert, who was only like a week old.
Yeah, I kept insisting on stops. And I, at one point as well, I just demanded like food. I was like, I'm not going anywhere until I've had a KFC. I was just like, I'm not doing anything until I've had a KFC. And remarkably, this is the weird thing, one arrived. I was starting to be a danger to myself and others. Like, I nearly hit Matt at one stage.
We reached a certain point where the crisis team people who were driving us there, who were absolutely amazing, we stopped at a garage, and the guy pulled me aside and said, "Look, we're kind of at Last Chance Saloon here. If we can't do this, then we're going to have to call the police, and she's going to have to be sectioned." And
have you ever had like PMT where it's really bad and you feel like you're being taken over by something?
Yeah, I have.
Right, it's like that, but on like a mega scale.
Right,
so that feeling that I get, like if I've got PMT, where I'm just like, I feel like something's moving through me.
Yeah, and you're like
saying things that I would not want to say.
Yeah,
but like convinced that that is how I feel.
Right. Yeah,
but it's not.
Yeah,
and like 3 days after you've had PMT, you'll be like, "Whoa, that was really
out
of order.
Why was I feeling so strong about that?" Yeah.
It's like, that is a really clear like link to me of feeling.
Yeah, you have times it.
And
by
also
tens,
where you want
to
like smash stuff.
Right. Yeah.
It was like that feeling, that energy inside me of just like destruction. We were about an hour away, and I knew that we were near my mum's house because she lives fairly near there. And they said, "We've got to get you to a place of safety." And in my psychotic state, I was like, "Well, why can't I go to my mum's?"
Right. Yeah.
That's a place of safety. And they were like, "No, we have to get you to the mother and baby unit." And I couldn't get round how they were saying that that wasn't a place of safety. I was like, if I could just get there and have a shower, something to eat and go to sleep, I'll be fine, you know?
Yeah.
But basically, this was when I'd got really aggressive and nearly hit Matt. So Matt and one of the crisis team had to go out, and I saw them talking.
It was going to really, really get a million miles away from anything that I wanted to happen. And so that was one of those times when it was just like, boom, look, this is what's going to happen. We need to do this. And somehow she managed to kind of fight through whatever it was to make that connection and do it.
And Matt came back in the car and basically everything about his energy seemed really different. And he just looked at me and he went, they're running out of options. This is your last chance. And he like just looked right at me and said it. And I was just like, something in me was just like, you can't mess this up now. You have to do everything in your body and everything you can because you're going to get separated from your child.
Right.
And I was like, I can't, I have to be with my son. Because I was terrified if the police were called or if I got separated, I was genuinely terrified what I might do.
Right, yeah.
So Matt and I sat forehead to forehead looking into each other's eyes for the rest of the journey.
Wow.
Whispering to each other. Like, it was like so beautiful and so awful because I was terrified that it would my body or my voice or something would let me down.
Right.
And would get me into trouble. Because I wanted to get there, but the psychosis was doing everything to destroy me.
Wow, my God.
And so I was like living with this, it's like a film where you're living with the enemy yeah. inside yourself.
It was doing anything that I could really just to remain the object of her attention more than anything and just make her feel all right because she was just, you know, you could tell she was terrified underneath everything. She was completely had been sort of taken over by this thing and didn't know what it was or why it was happening, and she was just terrified, and I was too. And so it was just having found that moment of connection, just keeping on doing the next thing to keep her sort of calm and contained until we reached safety.
And I just remember it was the early hours of the morning and I just saw the arch of the mother and baby unit and I was just like, oh, I've made it.
The kind of dawn was breaking on this kind of new day and we pulled into the car park and three of the nurses came out and sort of held Jess and took her in and it really felt like we had made it at that point.
Oh,
you know?
I bet.
But I mean, that was just the beginning of the next little bit, you know. But yeah, for that moment, it felt like we'd managed to at least get her there, you know.
And a few hours of just real calm, real peace, and then backlash. And I was like thrown into another chapter of horror. Basically.
Oh my days. Did you kind of know that you would get through it, or like did it feel like actually she might not come back as Jessica again?
Yeah,
or like what was it? What were your thoughts?
I think emotionally that was the most difficult thing, I think. Not knowing that we would come out of the other side. Because for a good few days I really feel like Jess was just gone, you know, like she was lost. Something else was there and at that point, like I say, as much as people can say, you know, she'll get better, there's a difference between knowing that and knowing it, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably the toughest time, that bit for the kind of couple of weeks after we had arrived at the unit, where she was supposedly in the place that she was supposed to be and yet not getting better quickly.
And so everybody has their own room there. Like, tell me what it's like.
Yeah, so it was like, I think they had 8 or 9 beds there at the time I was there. I think they've subsequently got 1 or 2 more. And you go in, it's got like a living area, a little sensory room, a kitchen, diner bit, and then all the rooms off the thing. And then like the hub, which is almost like, it's funny because at times it felt really lovely and at other times it felt like a prison, right, depending on my state of mind. And I was on like one-to-one observation for quite a long time.
Right. And so the nurses in the room with you all the time? Or
sitting outside they were with me all the time. But I didn't realise that. It was only when I started to get better, I realised that I was being observed. And that's a weird moment.
Right.
Because you're like, oh, they're watching me. Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Because when you're so ill, you don't know.
Right.
But when you start to get better, it's really freaky.
For the first little while, it was kind of like, going to visit was bittersweet because it was kind of steel yourself for it because it's going to be tough.
Right, I bet, yeah. Do you get much support yourself in that kind of situation?
Yeah, again, they're brilliant. The staff of the mother and baby unit, I just don't have high enough praise for them, and they seem to be able to take care of everyone with incredibly limited resources and but unending amounts of compassion and empathy.
I felt like there was a conspiracy not to feed me. I felt like my human rights were being violated. Now, it's interesting because, like, I can even see the funniness of it now. But when you actually genuinely think that people are starving you and not allowing you to wash, is like the most horrific feeling that you feel. I felt like I was being like slowly tortured. Like, and it was interesting as well, because then recovering as well, it was like understanding that I was doing that to myself was another layer of difficulty, because it's almost like, oh, well, they're doing it to me. But then realizing that I was doing that to myself was really painful. I was resisting medication. And actually, I met a person in there who we called each other flatmates, because she was lived next door to me. So we were like, we've got a 2-bed flat in Hackney. And she was what I called my psycho sister. I just remember her saying to me, just do it, like whatever medication they're giving to you, because she'd come in a day or two earlier. She was like, just take it. So we had amazing shared delusions. We were like, we were on like this sort of, they had like this committee meeting once a week or something to like talk to the patients. And we got in there and we were like fully psychotic. And we were like, we demand pedicures and like a whole list of things that weren't being done right at the unit, you know. So, yeah, we basically were ill together and recovered together, and we're still in contact now.
And her husband was there, and we talked a lot, because they, especially as they started to get better as well, they were sort of very close in there. And so it was lovely to maintain some sense of, I mean, normality is not quite the right word, but you know, that time at the beginning of the of your new baby's life, you know. And so there were some lovely times, you know, in there playing with the new babies.
Do they keep the child in each room with each mother, kind of thing, yeah, all the time?
Yeah, again, just depending on, but you know, the babies would often come out of the room at night, because a lot of the problem with a lot of us was we weren't sleeping. So it was really hard, because I used to have to take my medication and then go to leave Albert with someone. Oh, it was awful. Because it was like this little baby that I had to just hand him over, because I was like too medicated to care for him, and I could just hear him crying. I just have to cry myself to sleep hearing. And I'd like ring up Matt, because obviously he'd just left, but I'd phone him and I'd just be like, what's the point in me? What's the point in having a mum if I can't look after him and I can't be there for him and he's crying and I'm not looking after him? And I had code names for all the staff, so I had like, you know, like a Mother Mary and Helen of Troy, and I'd have all these names for them all. And that was again part of me trying to manage what was going on. But right, they were again like people that worked late and overtime and stayed with you and gave you that real, really saw you and looked after you, you know?
Right, yeah.
That taught me more about humanity than anything else I've ever experienced, because it was like, that's what being a real human is actually. That's what we've all got the capability to do.
And is there also an element of like, that's you at your hardest to look after state ever?
Yeah.
Like, and you were looked after. Is it something like that about human nature that we, you know, that we do that? You go somewhere, but you're brought back by humanity.
Yeah, like to go through that and have people that didn't know me, like they weren't doing that because they were being paid to do it. Like the overtime they must have put in.
I mean, you can only imagine what must have happened in the past. I mean, like,
oh yeah, because I probably would have died in a mental asylum. You know, not that long ago, women would have just been locked away.
Off, yeah. Locked and actually, away. It's such a temporary thing, isn't it? If you get the right treatment, from what I understand.
I mean, it was 3 or 4 months. Like three, I think I was in the mother and baby unit for about 2 or 3 months, and gradually was allowed leave. I mean, that's a whole nother story, if you like, because even getting to the stage where I had to work so hard to even get to the stage where I would be allowed out, or the first times I went for a walk outside were so frightening. You just can't, it's too stimulating, you know. I was going to say, I do remember being told I could go out one time, and I was just like determined that I wanted to go shopping, and I wanted to go. They were like, you mustn't go anywhere too stimulating. And I was like, had in my head that I was desperate to go to Westfield Shopping Centre. And they were like, seriously, that's not a great idea. So I got out of the ward round, and I just said to my mother-in-law and my husband, I was like, well, we need breakfast anyway, even if we're not going shopping. And I think we can all agree that the best place for breakfast is Westfield.
And did you feel nervous about coming home, or... or was she so much better that it was all right?
No, definitely not. Like, it, when we arrived home, it definitely was not at the happy ever after stage, you know. She was well enough to be home. But I remember coming back into the house, because I think by the time we got back there, we had lived in the, or Jess had lived in the unit for longer than we'd lived in the house that we had just moved into.
Right.
And so there was a real sense of dislocation and strangeness to it.
Must have been.
When we came back. And so I think we were both terrified, to be honest. Again. because very much apart from anything else, the unit had given Jess a sense of safety over that previous few months, you know, and then suddenly to be out in the real world again, I think, you know, Jess's confidence had taken a huge knock about whether or not she could do that.
Yeah, I bet.
It was so weird. It was like coming back to a weird museum. Like, it was like, had that slightly cold, damp type feeling because it hadn't been lived in for like 2 months. We'd only moved into it. We'd been away then more than we'd lived in it. And then it was just kind of like adjusting back to that and feeling really weird, because then it was like community visits and having to explain things again every day almost, because there wasn't much continuity then. And then the medication, like that again, that's a whole nother thing, which is so easy to be like, oh, and then I got home and la, la, la. But no, I was like on medication still, and I was on this certain medication called quetiapine, which I just hated, because I had felt like I had like locked in syndrome at night. I'd be like, I could hear Albert crying, but I couldn't move. It was awful. So I was just like, please take me off this. Because also I was on lithium as well, so I was having to go for blood tests. And
right.
I realised that even this recovery, the recovery was a huge deal.
Right, yeah.
And needed to be taken very gently and very slowly.
Is it the most challenging thing that you've ever been through?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Completely. And it changed me, and of course it changed Jess irrevocably, really. It's definitely the single most difficult thing that I've done in my life ever. Just because of the sheer number of things that you're having to deal with, and the fact that it's the person that you love, and seeing them go through this hell and trying to, like I say, trying to help, but in trying to help very often you make things worse. And so it taught me patience in a huge, huge way. And it taught me to be better at choosing my reactions. I mean, in the minutiae of the kind of the moments of it itself, you know, having to get to that point where I go, okay, this is how I feel that I want to respond to that. But actually, that's not helpful. That's not going to work. And it's the ultimate kind of suck it up thing, because it's not, the other person isn't in a state to kind of manage their reaction, right?
Yeah,
or their action, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a very, very kind of pivotal formative moment in my life, I think.
That's amazing. And did it have an impact on your mental health?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Hugely. Like I say, at the time, it's thing that you simply have no real choice but to get through, and so all of that time I was only really worried about how Jess was. But yeah, subsequently and it's interesting the symbolism of it, because I seem to remember that it started pretty much on the day that Jess came off her medication. So this is a good while later. She was taking lithium and again was determined that she didn't want to stay on it for longer than she needed to.
Yeah.
And I feel like it was the day that she sort of finished her medication that I started feeling really, really bad.
Interesting.
And went through a real kind of hard time, which was not at all just about the thing that I'd been through there. But I think when you go through something like that, it makes you question everything. You know, Jess was then able to help me through that, you know, so it was kind of tag team.
I always call Roxy a conversation that we had at the Playhouse Bar, because we were sat in the bar, this bar at the theatre one afternoon, and I just said to Matt, like, I really would love to have another baby. I'd love Albert to have a brother or sister. We were just like, yeah, do you know what, let's go. And because I said, to be honest, bearing in mind me and psychosis had this face off, I was just like, screw it, if psychosis is going to determine to me what I do is my life, no chance. So I was like, look, you know, should we just go for it? And the conclusion we both came to was, yeah. So we spoke to the psychiatrist and we dealt a lot with them leading up to it. And Matt and myself, we were both just like, we don't want to medicate the risk of it. And I totally can understand why people would.
Yeah.
Because the thought of it happening again is so awful and terrifying. And it was for us that you'd do anything to not have that happen.
Yeah.
But the way I felt and the way Matt felt was that we wanted to give this new baby also the opportunity to not have any of those things and to have the breastfeeding and the
right
and the, a mum that wasn't drugged up if we could at all help it.
Yeah.
So we were like, well, look, what we'll do is we'll set up a cast iron plan. If stuff starts going punky and we'll both know about it, we will just like click everything into place and medicate me. I'll take anything straight away.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So we did that, and incredibly, I mean, bearing in mind it was probably 50-50, nothing happened apart from joy and love.
Like, after she'd had the baby, you sort of like kind of absolutely sort of on edge of like...
Do you know what? When after we'd had Roxy, we drove in the car from the hospital. We were both quite hungry. It was something ridiculous in the morning. It was like 3 a.m. or something like that. And so we drove to the 24-hour McDonald's and got some chicken nuggets or whatever. And then drove home and Roxy was asleep and Jess looked at me and she said, I'm knackered, I'm going to bed. And I just thought, there you go, that's different. And somehow at that point, I... retrospectively, heroically, knew that it was going to be okay. that was the feeling that I actually had, you know, because that was definitely not how it was last time.
Right.
The idea of going, do you know what I need more than anything else? Sleep. That was something that did not happen the first time.
No.
So it felt completely different from the moment that we got home, really.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days.
But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Oh, so they went on to have another baby. That's fantastic news. I'm so pleased that Jess didn't get it again.
Yes, and I met Roxy when I went to interview them, and she's almost two now, their second child.
Okay.
It was really interesting, that decision to have another baby, but it seemed that there were several layers to the decision.
Yeah, kind of a good layer of bugger it, which, you know, definitely stands behind many of the best decisions, but they also had a really good backup of, you know, if it happens again, then we need a plan for what we'll do. So, you know, that was good.
Yes, their decision making has urged us into looking at decision making as a concept, hasn't it, Susan?
It has indeed, yeah.
So let's do what we do best and go off subject and have a chat about decision making.
Okay, go off at a complete tangent.
Here I go. So almost every decision we make, like, basically entails predicting the future. And in each case, we imagine how the outcomes of our choices will make us feel.
Okay, but the only problem is that we're not really very good at doing this, are we? So what advice would you have for someone who struggles to see how the future might pan out, you know, depending on different decisions?
Okay, so, you know, if you haven't got a crystal ball, then rather than looking inwards and imagining how a given outcome might make you feel, I think probably the best thing is to try and find someone who has made the same decision or choice and see how they felt.
Okay.
So whether it's moving to a new area, taking on a new job, getting a divorce, it might be worth talking to those who have been through it rather than just imagining how you think you will feel after making the decision. Remember also that whatever the future holds, it will probably hurt or please you less than you would imagine. That's been proven.
Oh, it's been proven by scientists in white coats. Then
it must be true.
But I do genuinely, I do think that's so true. I always think that making a decision is better than not making one. You know, I think not making a decision can actually be quite unsettling. It's almost as though you're saying to yourself that you don't have the capacity to decide or that you won't be able to manage the consequences. And it's almost quite undermining, I think. So I reckon it's good to do, you know, whatever needs to be done and then make the decision, believing that you'll be able to cope come what may. And at least I suppose it moves things forwards in some way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's nothing worse than living in limbo, is there?
Yeah,
absolutely. Because you can't make a decision.
Absolutely. Another part of decision making that I find quite interesting is this idea that sometimes you feel as though you're so far into something that you can't go back. Do you think that, you know, perhaps sometimes we make bad decisions because we feel we've already invested so much and so we feel that, you know, we just can't reverse that decision because we're so far down the line with something?
Yeah, I mean, I think so many tragic decisions have been made like this and so many monetary ones have. I mean, the thing that I think of when you say that is like the back of my wardrobe and there lurks like so many ill-fitting and outdated clothes that I've spent
seen
a fortune
them.
On.
Seen them.
Yeah, exactly. Most of you have seen them when I've been recording. At least they're doing something. They're softening
the
noise.
Yeah, that's true. A new lease of life.
Exactly.
A soundproofing.
There's clothes that you can't bring yourself to throw away because you've spent so bloody much money on them, but they don't fit or they don't look good anymore.
Yeah, I think it's called the sunk cost fallacy. I've heard of this one.
And
I think, you know, it's a good, well, you know, I like to do a bit of reading, just a little bit. Might sometimes, you know, be a good idea, though, to remind yourself that the past is the past and, you know, that money that you spent has already been spent. We obviously all hate to make a loss, but sometimes the wise option is just to stop throwing good money after bad. And there's a question that you can ask yourself, you know, where you think if at the time of considering whether to end a project, you wouldn't initiate it, then perhaps it's not a good idea to continue with that project.
Are you trying to tell me something? Is the backstory over?
My own subtle way of breaking it to you gently.
Live on what's it? Okay, so this brings us on to when there's too many options. This is something that I find when I go to the pub
every day.
Yeah, exactly, for lunch every day. when you're sort of, you look at the pub menu and you're just like, oh my god, this is like thousands
page
of different,
after page,
page after page.
After page.
I only need five options. I need five.
Yeah,
absolutely. No, I agree. Overchoice, this is an absolute pet hate of mine. We always assume that more choice is a good thing, and I just don't think it is. I think more choice is utterly baffling.
Yeah, there was an episode of The Simpsons where they went to Monstro Mart, where their slogan was "Shopping is a baffling ordeal," and there was this like endless array of choices. And this has been found to be true in the real world as well, because Tesco made some big changes following an analysis that showed that they had 28 ketchups on offer.
Who needs 28? The choice of different.
And Aldi only offered one.
Okay.
And again, Tesco's had like 220 different kinds of air freshener. And I think the trouble is also online shopping only makes that worse, because it's not like it's even using shelf space up, is it?
No, absolutely. Just pile on the choice. Yeah.
This level of choice is known to be too confusing and can lead to paralysis.
Yeah, you just spend so much time weighing up the alternatives that in the end, I think sometimes you end up doing nothing. And also more choice kind of increases the chances, in your mind, perhaps, that you might make a mistake. So you can end up feeling less satisfied with your choice, because there's always that niggling fear, isn't there, that, you've missed a better opportunity. You've missed choosing the one ketchup that would have been, the most amazing ketchup in the world.
Definitely. I mean, I'm faced with this on a daily basis with, two young children, and they're a good illustration of the fact that don't give them too much choice, because like children can't make a choice from many things. They just need one or two options, and usually it's only one for me.
Yeah, my way or the highway.
Exactly, it's fish fingers or nothing. So there we go.
Fish fingers or early bed.
Yeah.
Well, that was good. It's nice to have a good kind of meaty discussion every once in a while. Okay, Claire, moving on to our podcast recommendation this week.
Yes, podcast this week is more of a podcast episode recommendation rather than series.
Okay.
It's from This American Life, which of course is a titan of the podcast world.
We all bow down before it. But, even with This American Life, I think there are some episodes that are better than others, perhaps.
Exactly. So I do think it's really useful to have an episode recommendation every so often, just to get you back into, a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So here it is. I think that Rom-Com was a particularly good episode, and Act 4, You Had Me at Hello, is a great part.
Yeah, because it's always broken down into four acts, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay. I like This American Life have this thing, I think, on their app where they have favourite episodes chosen by their different contributors, which I think is a really lovely idea. So we would love to hear your favourite episodes of The Backstory or any other podcast.
We can't afford the app.
No.
But we just want your episodes.
Yeah, just let us know. We'll put anything that you send in, we'll put out on social media as well. So this is our favourite episodes shout out. Let's share, because it's a really good way to get into new podcasts, by being recommended a particular episode and why you like it.
Exactly.
So this episode of This American Life, why did you like that in particular, Claire?
Well, You Had Me at Hello, which is the section I was talking about, is about a date, and it's about love, and it's about loads. It has loads of twists and turns. It's a real great plot. I won't spoil it for you, but it's a slice of audio gold.
Okay, just an old romantic at heart, aren't you? Which brings us on to our Christmas giveaway. Drum roll, please. I think we can all agree this is a pretty huge announcement. So if you're standing or operating heavy machinery, then we would ask you to sit down, because really this is fairly massive news. We will be giving away a pair of lovely headphones, some books, chocolate, and wait for it, a very prized Backstory mug.
With a new logo on it.
Absolutely, yeah. Only 6 of these bad boys exist anywhere in the world. So, we are talking family heirloom status here.
We'll be putting this out across our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. To take part, just make sure you're subscribed to The Backstory and like and share our post, and we'll announce the winner shortly before Christmas.
As ever, thanks for listening. We're back next week with a brand new backstory from Terry. Terry was diagnosed a few years ago with Parkinson's disease, and he'll be telling us how it was to get his diagnosis and how his life and the lives of those around him had changed since then.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We are The Backstory Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, at The Backstory Pod on Twitter. Search for The Backstory with Claire and Susie in your podcast directory.
For sponsorship opportunities, or if you'd like to take part in a show, please contact hello@thebackstorypodcast.co.uk. The Backstory Podcast is produced by Tinshed Productions.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.